Hello, everyone. Welcome to the 217th episode of the Atlas Society Ask. My name is Lawrence Olivo, the Senior Project Manager here at the Atlas Society, the leading nonprofit organization introducing young people to the ideas of Ayn Rand in creative ways like through animated videos and graphic novels. This week, our CEO, Jennifer Grossman, has it off. She won't be here today, but I am excited to have join me Atlas Society Senior Scholar and Professor of Political Economy at Duke University, Richard Salzman, along with Atlas Society Senior Fellow Robert Trzynski. Now, for those of you watching this on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, you can use the comment section to type in your questions, and we'll try to get to as many of them as we can. Now, as you can tell from the title of this video, Richard and Rob will be discussing immigration today, covering many topics, including open borders versus closed borders versus managed borders, along with asking questions related to immigration and our current welfare state. So without further ado, let me pass things over to Rob. Thank you for joining us.
And thanks, everyone, for coming. So the reason I want to talk about that, I kind of proposed this topic because we're in the election season and candidates are starting to make promises and they're starting to make bad promises, right? So we can hash out, I'm sure, at length with Richard. And I think he and I will be 100%, we don't agree on everything about the election, but we'll agree 100% on, you know, Kamala Harris proposing price gouging laws, which are basically price controls, and on some of the, I think there's something about taxing unappreciated, unrealized gain, capital gains. These are really bad economic ideas. But I also wanted to talk, because you can't let anybody off the hook, want to talk about what I think is the worst economic and political and, you know, in many other ways, the worst idea probably on the Republican side, which is this idea of mass deportation. You know, I think the tariffs are a bad idea, but mass deportation is one that I think is people are underappreciating. And this is the idea that not only we're going to halt immigration, we're going to crack down on immigration, we're actually going to go after the this is up to 20 million people who are here already, who have immigrated illegally, and we're going to round them up. We're going to send them out. And, you know, this may not, 20 million may not happen, but, you know, in an interview, J.D. Vance was asked, well, can you really deport 20 million people? He says, well, how about 1 million? We'll start with that. So, you know, I think that is itself also is a bad idea. And now I want to talk, I think Richard can talk a lot about the economics of immigration and why, you know, we need immigrants. And I think philosophically, the issue that I see is that it depends on if you view people as a burden or people as an asset. If you see people as productive individuals who add something to the economy and add something to a society, versus, you know, them being purely a drain. And you hear this a lot on the Republican side that, oh, immigrants are all here, they just want to be on welfare, they're criminals, they don't want to work, they just be I want to be on welfare. Although there's always a curious contradiction there. Somebody calls this Schrodinger's immigrant. They're sort of, they are and they aren't, which is on the one hand, they're going to take all our jobs. On the other hand, they don't want to work. They want to go on welfare. Now, what actually happens is immigrants come here and they do work. They often are very entrepreneurial. They start new businesses at a very high rate. They do not commit crimes. From the statistics I've seen, they do not commit crimes at a higher rate. So, you know, this idea that they're criminals, they don't go on welfare at a higher rate. They work, they create things, they produce, they bring new cuisines. So, you know, this anti-immigrant attitude is completely misplaced. But what I want to talk about to begin with is, because I'm the politics guy, I want to talk about more of the political aspect of it, which is the idea of mass deportation, I think, has a particularly grim aspect to it, and create, you know, this idea that, okay, we're gonna find all the people who are already here and get rid of them. Now, you know, on the economic level, that's a bad idea because what you have is, you know, we have a actual shortage of workers in the economy, and you're going to get rid of 20 million of them. That's not going to create new jobs for everybody who's left. That's going to actually, you know, cause a sort of economic decline, an economic catastrophe. It would cause a new recession, possibly a severe one. But then there's the political aspect of how do you go about getting rid of all these people who are here in America, who are working, who have lived here for decades, who have, you know, established themselves. How do you go and root them all out and then deport them? And the scale of this sort of police state kind of tactics that would be required for that is the thing that I find most concerning about this. So, for example, well, to give an example of the problems you're going to come up with, I saw an interesting article a few months ago about a guy in Florida who has lived in America his whole life. He just finished working for 40 years, paying his taxes. He goes to apply for a Social Security check, and they say, well, we can't give you Social Security. We have no record. You're a citizen. And he goes there and he finds out that, in fact, he is not. He was came here illegally, and he never became naturalized. He is not a U.S. citizen. You know, he came here illegally as an infant, basically. And so he's not a U.S. citizen. Well, the kicker in that story is they have the photo of the guy, and behind him is a Trump flag. Right. So here's a guy saying, oh, we got to get rid of those illegal immigrants. Those people are dragging down the country. And it turns out he's one of them. So there's going to be a lot of cases like that of people who in many cases, you know, did not even know they were illegal, or people who don't have the documentation. You know, if you were asked to, you know, pull out, you know, bring the paper showing that you're a U.S. citizen. Now, some of us, you know, could do that. The Trzezinskis have been here a couple of generations, and I'd have a presumptive case. But, you know, it's going to create a lot of problems and a lot of potential injustices. And then also the thing I talk about with the enforcement is this idea that we're the police don't exist to do it. The law enforcement infrastructure does not exist to do an enforcement effort this large. So there was talk, I don't know if this is from Trump directly, but some of the people around him, that we'll send in the National Guard. And, you know, if the New York National Guard won't go in and root people out in New York, we're going to send the Missouri National Guard or the Florida National Guard. We're going to send them in to New York to go door to door and round these people up. Well, you know, I think you can see that there's really no way to do that. Excuse me, I have a bit of a cough. No way to do that that doesn't result in a constitutional crisis and all sorts of political problems. So I think from the political perspective, this is really asking for, you know, years of political crisis for even the attempt to do this. Years of court cases, years of potential injustices to people get, and all that, turning everything over for something that is actually going to be bad for the country. So I want maybe to invite Richard at this point to comment on that part, but also comment on, I'm going to defer to you on the economics of it, because I know you know these issues very well.
Well, I do want to touch on, I think we promised them ethics, economics, and politics. Mm-hmm. That's a lot, the mouthful. And I think actually all three are in your commentary, Rob, which is mm-hmm. great. And I want to do that too. But I have broader points to make and principles to name, but I for the purpose of the flow of the conversation, I will address this right away, the deportation. Yes, on the surface, it looks very grim and very police state and very rough and very show us your papers. Although the part that says show us your papers, I mean, that sounds Nazi, but every time somebody asks for a license to buy beer or vote or anything like that, you're effectively asking, what you're asking for is, who are you? And are you a citizen? And those are related, I think, closely to whether you can vote or not, whether you can do a whole bunch of, you know, legal things, including getting driver's license in the country. I think, though, deportation, to not drop the context here, it's a problem, or call it a policy response to a whole bunch of other problems, namely the borders aren't being managed. And so millions of people are coming in, and because the borders are not being managed properly, we don't know who these people are. And the idea of deporting, I think, is more like the flip side of amnesty. Rob, you remember in mid-80s, I think it was called Simpson-Mazzoli, Reagan's view was, well, we can take in immigration, but we need to fix the immigration system. We'll grant them amnesty. So he was not so harsh as to come up with deportation, as you know, although that was a small part of the program. But the idea was, grant these people amnesty. I forget how many millions it was. And then fix the immigration system, actually secure the border, put money into INS and other things. And Congress basically reneged on the deal. They didn't do it. So we've had, you know, subsequent 40 years of this kind of thing. And it does ebb and flow and everything. But I can't say that I'm against deportation, but it's like saying, what do you do after the government wrecks the economy? Should it bail out the banks or not? Well, the bigger problem is it already wrecked the economy, you know, and nobody wants to bail out the banks or do anything nasty or reckless. But we have to remember the context, that the fundamental thing for me is neither closed borders, which is the Trump type approach, or completely open borders, which is the Democrats approach. I've often used the phrase the Ellis Island model, which is managed borders. It kind of basically says anyone can come in anyone really can come in, with three exceptions. They can't be, you know, contagious disease. They can't be like hardened criminals. I don't mean just jaywalking, but, and then the other one normally is either terrorists, or if you've identified foreign countries that are enemies of the United States, those people can't come in. Now, except for those three exceptions, that does allow a lot of people in. And I think during the 1892 to 1954 period, Ellis Island brought in something like 12 million. But in the data I looked at, I never saw more than 10 or 15% of the U.S. population at the peak that immigration represented. So what I'm saying is, especially under Obama and then especially under Biden, they let in so many people undocumented. I think they should have been documented through processing centers. They deliberately do not do that. I'm not sure why they deliberately don't do it. But there are people who are legally processed. We know who they are. We know whether they fall into those three categories. We try to make sure they don't. And I just think the deportation problem, just honing in on that and on the kind of grim aspects to it, it drops the context of how we got to the point where we don't know who these people are. And actually, I actually agree with most of the kind of insights and statistics you named. I'm not one of these people who think immigrants are necessarily a drain on the country, or they're above average criminals, or a welfare, you know, lazy people or anything like that. But the problem is, you don't know, these numbers are murkier and murkier, because precisely we don't know who they are. So I'm not even sure we can trust the immigration numbers anymore, because so many of them are undocumented.
And well, how do you count something that's undocumented by its nature? It's not, it's estimated, but not counted.
When it starts becoming, you know, 5 million, 6 million, 7 million, I worry that the ones that are undocumented are precisely the ones that might fall into those negative categories that I mentioned. So I'll stop there, but that's just
I wanted to agree with you in part that yes, I think there has been a failure to let in documented immigrants, but I have a somewhat different diagnosis as to the cause, which is that I think we've not allowed enough people in to come legally. I think this was Reagan, I'm trying to remember, you might let me know if this rings a bell, but he said something like, we have high walls and wide doors.
Yes.
And the idea is we're going to let in a lot of immigrants, and I think our system, I think illegal immigration is the system we voted for over the years. And it's because what we've done is there's this tremendous economic incentive and political incentive. I mean, a lot of people coming here. So one of the things that's changed in recent years is that the people coming across the border from Mexico are not it's not primarily Mexicans anymore. It's a lot of people coming from farther south. They're coming from Honduras, and they're coming from very turbulent and chaotic places in Central America. You have people going, coming from China, you know, because we've really clamped down on immigration from China, but people want to get out as it becomes somewhat more authoritarian recently. So you have people coming from China, they're going and crossing the Darien Gap between, you know, they can come to South America, they cross the Darien Gap into Panama, and they make their way up to the southern border. And I think that comes from the fact that we have, it's kind of like, you know, any system where the government says, look, there are huge incentives to do this, but we're going to pass a law saying you can't. Well, you can, if you don't address the incentives, you can't pass a law saying the incentives are going to go away. And oftentimes you then end up passing a law that you can't really enforce. And I think that's what we have is I like the idea of, you know, managed borders, if it were the Ellis Island model, which is, yes, everybody can come in, but you will be processed, you will be screened. Yeah. And I think we could realistically enforce that if it weren't for the, you know, because right now anybody with malicious intent who's trying to cross the border, anybody who'd be screened out, you know, they can hide among millions of just ordinary people who are coming across because they're poor and desperate and you know, afraid of being, you know, killed by the junta wherever they came from, that sort of thing. I think that's why I say it's not just a Democratic failure, it's a bipartisan failure. And it's because of this issue we have not been able to agree as a country of, do we want immigration or not?
Well, I'm not sure if you go back and look at, I agree that it used to not be a bipartisan thing, but I think it is now. If you go back and look at, you know, quotes from Clinton, Bill Clinton, and earlier than that, the old, you know, the old Democrat Party before they became totally crazy. But even Obama had many deportations, but the numbers were so low, they didn't make the radar screen. But they've changed enormously party-wise. But instead of getting into the point now, it's a total it, before it, they used to be very close together, the two parties on this. And they kind of had this view that immigration is good. Let's have these exceptions for nasty immigrant and nasty people. But otherwise, okay, you know, there's going to be waves. Remember Cuba? There are going to be waves that occur. We have to figure out how to adjust maybe. And then there's the M1, what is it called? The M1B visas for engineers in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, H1B,
people.
Yeah.
That's a whole different, yeah, that's a whole different discussion. But what I've noticed in the last 15, maybe 10 or 15 years or so, is the parties went this way. I'm moving my fingers apart here.
Yeah.
And they've given us a false alternative. And they're feeding off of each other in a way that I know you and I hate. So like on the one hand, someone will say open borders. We have no idea who's coming in. They could be blowing up buildings. And we can't even document, since they're undocumented.
Yeah.
We can't any more reliably document whether they do have low crime rates, whether they do actually go to work, whether they do pay taxes, you know, whether they do add to the culture and all those kinds of things. It becomes harder and harder to measure. But then on the other hand, the reaction to this is that seems so outrageous. And I think it is outrageous. And it's actually inhumane what you see going on the border, the capturing of kids and stuff like that, the breaking up of families. The other side becomes all, you know, East Berlin on us. They go all East Berlin on us. They build a wall. I'm generally against walls, but I want processing. And that does mean there has to be, Rob, you would agree, there has to be a tangible border, whether it has to be these 20-foot walls. I'm not saying that. But I'm more intrigued by, what do you think is the reason? Because I'm not sure I really have found one. Why isn't there a bipartisan support for putting a lot of money into, I don't even know what they call it anymore. Is it INS? They've changed the name so many times. Here, to me, is a legitimate government function, an actual legitimate government function, you know, like integrity of the borders. It's a central definition of any nation state. And they're violent, and they're not doing it. They're doing every other goddamn thing, like central banking and taxing and all these other things, public school, and they won't do this thing.
Well, maybe. Okay.
And the question is, why won't they do it? Why both parties won't get together and say, as you say, call it not the Ellis Island model, but the Reagan model, walls, not walls tangibly, but walls in the sense of symbolically or figuratively or tangibly, we're going to process everyone. And it could be millions of people. We don't have a problem with that. But you do have to put resources into it. You have to build up border patrol. You do have to build up the gateways, literally, the processing centers. That's what I mean by Ellis Island. There should, to me, on the southern border, there should be like 25 of those, 25 like huge processing centers. And I'm not sure they have even, I don't know, I'm not sure what they have down there, but they're clearly being overrun. And Rob, if you and I were in Central America and we were poor, Lisa said this to me the other day. She said, wouldn't you want to come in illegally? I said, damn right. I would try to get up here and come in. Now, on the other hand, I'm like a guy who, you know, would want to work, raise a family, break no laws. But I'm not sure everybody's like that. But that is another way of looking at it. If we were in that position and the U.S. had the same porous borders and it was dangerous and it was all these things and you run the risk of being illegal, would you do it anyway? Yeah, if you wanted freedom and opportunity. That's a hard argument.
And safety. I mean, safety is an major thing. I got to get killed. Well, so when this is kind of a tangent, but I just came across an interesting argument somebody made to me about how it's a paper I read talking about how brain drains are actually good for the countries that have brain drains. And it was a perspective I hadn't heard before, but they basically said, first of all, you know, your talented people are able to go off and do well and make money and send it back home. And furthermore, there's more incentive for people to become doctors and lawyers and have acquire all these skills, because if you have the ability, oh, if I acquire this skill, I can go to America. That gives people more incentive. They don't all leave. Some of them stay, right? Yeah. So you actually end up with more doctors and lawyers.
Right.
And then the last thing is there's evidence that countries have large amounts of immigration to free countries. Those countries end up having a better record of freedom. And that was kind of counterintuitive to me, because I thought, well, maybe all the most pro-freedom loving people would leave. But what actually happens is people end up with this connection. They know what things are like in America. They have this connection to America and they begin to import some of those ideas back. So it's like, I think it is a giant win-win. You know, it's a win for the country that loses the people. It's a win for us for gaining, you know, enterprising people. I mean, like Haitians are among one of the most successful, you know, terrible, horrible dictatorship at home. They come here and they're incredibly successful and productive people. But I want to talk about why we don't have this, because I think that's a curious question. So one of them is, you know, we just had a deal on this that was offered that would boost a lot of this enforcement efforts, and the Republicans turned it down despite being the ones to negotiate it. So it gets caught up in electoral politics. But also the second part about that is, I hate to break it to you, Richard, but I think you'd be seen as among a lot of people on the right, you'd be seen as a wild-eyed open borders fanatic. And that's because, you know, I think the reason we don't have 25 processing centers where we let people in and we check them out and then say, okay, go on your merry way, go get a job, is because there's a lot of people who, you know, there's always this sort of level of saying, oh, I'm not against immigrants, I'm just against illegal immigrants. But if you push those people often, what you get is, I'm against immigrants. Then arguments like, oh, they're going to change the culture and they're going to, or they're coming from unfree countries, so they're going to make it less free here. They're going to go vote in, you know, illegal immigrants are going to vote and they're going to fix the election for the Democrats. Or, you know, they're criminals and they're bad and they're going to be on welfare. All these arguments that we've heard. And the thing I find interesting about a lot of those, by the way, is that a lot of them are recycling of things that were said about the Poles and the Italians and the Irish 100 years ago. I caught one of these things, very highly sort of xenophobic thing from a far out, far right guy. And his name was Joey Manarino. And I thought, hey, I'd like to see this guy go back and look at what they were saying 100 years ago about guys named Manarino when they came here.
Well, I agree that to the extent, but I think it occurs on the right and the left. And in the middle, I guess, we always forget about the middle. I do believe that maybe part of the reason they're reluctant, both sides, to come to this kind of deal that says, let's pour a lot of money. And I don't think it would take a lot of money.
No.
Maybe it would take like 1/10 of the Defense Department budget. Now, what would that be?
That'd be like maybe 80 70 billion.
I did look up the numbers on how much Border Patrol is paid now, but or how much it would be to construct those processing centers. But it's only a 700-mile border. I can't imagine it would take that much. You'd have to do other things on other parts of the border. But my point is, I do think that you can find on the right, but also on the left, this kind of nativism, this kind of xenophobia. Outright racism, a hatred of, but you're right, that goes all the way back to the Ellis Island. The Italians hated the Irish, and the Irish hated the Italians, and the French hated the Germans. And yet we still took them in here's a challenge I would make. The Ellis Island model, every time I bring it up, quite rightly, someone will say to me, because the Ellis Island model was roughly 1892 to 1954, it closed in 1954, but the peak was really in 1920, 21 or so, because so many people came over during World War I from Europe that Congress, I think in 2022, 1923, really restricted more immigration. So if you look at the numbers, they really go very high, 1892, for about 30 years. But what the pushback I get is they'll say, well, that was not a full-fledged welfare state. And the point is, that's true. So in other words, the American welfare state didn't really begin to grow up until the New Deal, right? So Americans seeing this flood of people coming in 1892 to 1920s or so, not only could they realize they were being checked these three ways, that they're not criminals, they're not contagious and that, but they also knew they were probably likely coming here for freedom and opportunity, not to suck off the tit of the welfare state. The problem we have today, Rob, is if you lean too far in the direction of let them all in, we don't have a kind of limited government system now. So I'm somewhat sympathetic, not to the nativist argument, not to the xenophobic. I'm somewhat more sympathetic. And even Milton Friedman said this. He said, listen, I'm for freedom. I wish we had freedom across the board. But if you have a welfare state, you can't be quite as free about your border policy. Now, I think that's actually regretful. I think it's a sign of what Hayek called controls breeding controls.
Yes,
like if you have statism in one area, you end up—
That's exactly what I was going to say.
It's awful in that regard. And so we need some system of unwinding it, but I definitely lean in the direction of not only for political economic reasons, but ethical reasons. We want to be the country that's a magnet for brains and liberty lovers and people
not just brains, but also, I mean, I there tends to be a thing that it's easier to sell people on. Well, it's sometimes easier to sell people on the idea that, okay, we should let people in who are doctors and who are—
I don't mean who are talented, who are educated.
Yes.
No, I mean, it could include entrepreneurial brains and, you know, people who want to start businesses. I just meant—
As you know, my wife's in the construction industry. She deals all the time with guys who are framers, who are plumbers, who are electricians, who are bricklayers. People with, people who are not doing, high skilled labor, but they're adding something really constructive. I'd like to see what happened to the construction industry if you got rid of all the Mexicans. And so the thing is that, these are people who come to work. And I think so that this, I knew this would come up, but I was going to bring it up if you didn't, which is this Milton Friedman argument. And it's one that's like custom tailored to appeal to guys like you and me, right? Because, with welfare state, that's bad. So we should. That's a good argument against immigration, but I think it's his worst argument, his least convincing argument. And the reason, first of all, is partly what you said, the controls be controls, that if you set up the standard, we can't have freedom in one area until we have perfect freedom in these other areas. Or, we can't have more immigration. And I'm a political realist, right? So I know that we're not going to have the laissez-faire utopia in my lifetime, most likely, unless I live to be extremely old.
I didn't know. Oh my God.
So I don't like to talk about things like, should we have open borders as the ideal? It's like, well, that's not even on the table right now. No. I call that sort of libertarian debate club. We could talk about how would things work in a perfect ideal society, but that's not politically what's happening right now. What I say the issue is, I think what we need is a policy that is more welcoming toward legal immigration. One that says, okay, we're going to have the processing centers. We're going to let the people in. I think it will solve a lot of the problem. But the thing is that we have a lot of evidence of what these people actually do when they come here, and they're not taking welfare. I think we've also, and I don't have the details of this, but I think we've also had a couple rounds of welfare reform that basically says, you are not eligible for welfare. Now you can, there's ways to game it and to defraud the system. But this idea, you're not eligible, and some cities may not enforce it, but the idea that you are not eligible for welfare if you're illegal. So, for example, this guy I mentioned who had come here illegally and worked here for 40 years, paid taxes, and then he can't get Social Security. And that's part of one of those laws. But the interest, I think because of that, the figures I've seen are that they are actually net payers into the welfare state, because there's all sorts of people who come here and work, illegal immigrants who come here and work and pay into the welfare system through taxes, through payroll taxes, but then who never end up collecting. And some it's like young guys who come here to make money so they can build a house back home, and then they go back home. So they come here for 5 years or 10 years, and then they go back. Or other people who come here and aren't eligible to collect various welfare state benefits, and so they never draw from the system. So they're paying more in taxes than they're drawing out. Those, now, like I said, all these are estimates, we don't know for sure, but those are the best estimates I've seen.
Let me say, I like those comments. It's interesting that on the Friedman thing, by the way, I always smiled when I would hear that, because you could go either way.
Yeah.
When Milton Friedman says, you have a big welfare state, you're going to be careful about taking immigrants in. Well, you could reduce the welfare state.
Yeah. We can't have a welfare state because we have immigrants.
Reduce the man. And he, to his credit, he tried in some cases with the negative income tax to reduce the welfare state. So you could go the route of, if you think that's the problem, or you could go the route of, and sometimes he would say, we can't fight the welfare state. Since we can't fight the welfare state, we'll fight like complete open immigration, because it will, overrun the borders and bankrupt the welfare state. So, but you could go either way. So it's not a terrible argument, but it at least is someone pointing out that you can't just have an immigration policy that's fairly liberal, of the kind I think you do and I agree with, out of context. Is this 1922 or is this 2022? Yeah. And that's the part where I'm sympathetic to people who worry that we've created this magnet. Now, the other thing I want to say is, I want to push back, Rob, a little bit. I know you're not in this ethical camp, but part of the argument you're using, and I've resisted with other people, is this kind of cost-benefit analysis of, well, they contribute this and they take away that, and there's benefits here and there's hazards there. And it's kind of like an overarching, you hear this sometimes also where people will say, well, we want immigration, but we want to like figure out whether they're doctors or not, or whether we need more janitors, or whether we need more swim coaches. That approach bothers me, because I would rather set up just objective standards of, you get to come in if you don't have all these risks that I already named. And you exclude things like, bad countries to us. But the idea of picking and choosing winners like we do with, it sounds utilitarian to me. It sounds like you're doing a collective societal welfare calculation about whether we should take in immigrants generally. And I would much prefer setting up a standard and then just see who meets it. And it could be a European, it could be an Asian, it could be a Guatemalan, But I don't want to sit there at putting up quotas in advance, either for certain kinds of countries or certain kinds of professions. I kind of want to leave that to the market and people themselves deciding, hey, should I go and try to be a doctor in America or not? So yeah. What do you think about that? Do you get that?
Well, I agree with that as the ideal. What I would say is tactically, I'm okay with saying, you know, if in one particular case saying, look, why are we getting H1B visa guys? They just won a big international cricket match for us. Isn't that amazing? So you had these guys. So there's in India, there's two big cricket teams, India A and India B. And they had this one in America that defeated Pakistan, which is one of the top teams in the world. And somebody said, well, that's not India B, it's India H1B. Yeah, it's a bunch of Indian immigrants and people from the Caribbean who came to America as immigrants. They're working for tech companies and they won cricket. You know, we should bring in talented people. And if that moves the needle on at least loosening up some of this, because I really do think these controls that exist right now are holding back progress. And by making people come illegally, you hold back people from fully integrating into the economy. And, you know, you're also, I think, you know, the restrictions we have right now make it harder for, I think, actually put a bias towards the unskilled immigrants coming. Because if you're willing to just cross the border and get construction jobs as well, you know, as you catch can, you will come here. But if you're a doctor and you want to work as a doctor, not being, you know, being illegally here is going to be a real problem for you. You're not going to be able to licensure. You're not going to be able to get a job. It's going to be a lot less attractive to you. So I think it's actually preferentially keeping out the talented people. So that's one of the things I think we need to look at. But I want to also make a case to provide some sympathy for the left on this, which is, I think, part of their opposition to making the kind of deal you want, Richard, is that I think they sense that the right wants more enforcement, not because they want to have people be documented but still come in. The right wants more enforcement because they want them out. They don't want them to come in at all. And there's a history behind this that I think, you know, I've begun to take more and more seriously, because I start hearing some people, and this is like the far, far right people these days, but they're louder than they used to be. And a lot of them are complaining about the Immigration Act of 1965. Now, what did the Immigration Act of 1965 do? Well, it changed the quotas to allow more people from Africa and Asia.
Right.
And, you know, before it was fixed to people from
mostly Europe. Yeah.
From Europe. Right. And that was part and parcel of Jim Crow. Because part of the reason for that is, you know, more black people coming, more people of non-white ethnic racial minorities coming in. The South saw that and said, well, those people aren't going to like segregation. Their children and grandchildren are going to vote against segregation, so we can't let them in. And so there is a certain set, and I do see that, you know, some of the messaging on this sometimes too. There was something that was tweeted out a while back by someone very prominent, where it was like, well, here's your suburb, here's America with closed borders and border enforcement, and it's this beautiful, peaceful, bucolic suburb, and here it is with immigrants, and nobody in the picture was not black. It was basically, we will be overrun by hordes of black people. And so there is almost like, there's an attempt to create this sort of xenophobic fear. These people are other. They're different from you. They're not like us good people. And, you know, like I said, the irony is us good people were the people who were viewed as the foreign hordes and the rabble. By the way, on the Germans, the Salzmans, I came across a fascinating little history about World War I. During World War I, there was a vast anti-German hysteria. And there were dozens of German language newspapers in the U.S. and they were shut down and you know, people who were German changed their names so that they wouldn't sound German enough. So, you know, every ethnic group has had this sort of,
and of course the Japanese campaign. Faced the same thing with the internment. Yeah.
And so I think that sort of that xenophobic aspect of it is one of the things that the left is reacting to.
The sympathy I have for not the far right wackos and the xenophobes, the sympathy I also have, but this is very crude fear. It's that part of Americana that says we're losing our culture, we're losing the 1950s white picket fence middle class suburban America because of immigration, and therefore we don't want immigration, or the culture is changing, or they won't accept our language. That's actually not, to me, an unimportant thing. You know, Ellis Island, one of the first things they did was they go over to the language office and learn the language. course, that's not true anymore. So these critics will say something like, they're not only not learning the language, they go into our public schools and they demand that English is a second language. So that kind of cultural lack of assimilation on the part of immigrants coming in, I am sympathetic to people who resist, but I wouldn't resist it to the point of closing the borders or restricting the incoming as the way they do. But let me ask you something, Rob. Flip the script here and answer this question. Why do you think, I understand why you're saying the right doesn't want them in, but we know the left won't sign an immigration bill either that processes in the way we do. Why do you think they want them to come in undocumented in the millions with this chaos regardless? In other words, they're not sitting there saying that is really inhumane and that is crazy and that is dangerous, so we're going to wait around for a bipartisan immigration bill. They're not waiting around. What do you think their motive is? You think it's totally electoral?
I don't think it's electoral. I don't think they think illegal immigrants are going to vote for them, because there's not any real evidence that that happens. People tried to drum it up, but it's really kind of unconvincing. I haven't seen the numbers. It's very small numbers.
You don't think California went from Reagan country to Newsom country in 40 years because of immigration?
I think it did it because of immigration, but not because of illegal immigration. That is, it wasn't, or rather, it wasn't people who were legal voting. It was like the next generation of people after that. And, you know, all the hippies in Haight-Ashbury. I mean, one of the things we have to take into account is that a lot of the, you know, if you look at who's the leaders of the left, it's a bunch of people named Warren and Sanders, right? A bunch of white people named Warren and Sanders and heck, you know, now who have we got now? Waltz, right? You know, a German immigrant from Minnesota. So I think it's kind of simplistic to say, oh, we went to the left. I have seen an interesting analysis that okay, California.
So if it's not electoral, what do you think they're, why do you think they're
supporting? Well, two things. One is, I think if you go back far enough, Democrats were not pro-immigration at all.
No.
One thing I've noticed, for example, is Joe Biden, the one thing he hasn't changed from Donald Trump is he didn't get rid of the tariffs.
Right.
Why? I remember the 1980s. I remember when the Democrats were the tariff party. They were the guys who wanted to, you know, keep the Japanese from importing all those automobiles.
Right.
And so, you know, that's Joe Biden for all the way back. That's the old.
Well, that's on tariffs. So that's on importing goods, not importing people.
But the other thing I would say about Democrats
have changed on this. Then, you know,
I think Democrats would actually accept a deal like you're saying. I think they viewed it a huge win to have something even a little close to what you're saying, if it actually included the provisions about letting more people in. But the problem, and I've been watching these negotiations for years, and it's never about that. If Republicans said, look, we will raise all the caps and quotas, we'll provide funding for such and such more bureaucrats to process these applications, as long as we then, you know, have more budget to control the border. I think there are a lot of Democrats who would sign up for that, but that's I think there are a lot of Republicans who would balk at it, and they would say, oh no, that's letting in these, you know, all these foreigners who are going to destroy our culture.
Yeah. So I'm glad we brought up these past examples of like Reagan, although again not perfect, or Clinton from the 90s, again although not perfect.
I just looked up something on Reagan that his very last speech he gave in the White House is described as somebody described it as a love letter to immigrants.
Yeah,
he was waxing eloquent about all the things immigrants have added to this country.
He was very good on.
The left right things have sort of switched back and forth over the years.
They have switched back and forth. Those two were not only very decent on immigration, I thought, but the two parties were much closer. So the paradox, really, or the tragedy, if you will, is why they've split so much since, and why there seems to be no solution. And each side seems more and more advocating policies which look really inhumane. I think we can say on both sides, this flooding over of anarchy is inhumane and maybe dangerous. But also the where are your papers and I'm going to deport you is inhumane and authoritarian as well. So it's so tragic, right? So Rob, if you and I crafted, which we could do probably in 60 minutes, an immigration package, you know, that said we need to massively, and for the first time ever, an objective that says massively increase government spending on this legitimate function. And here's how many processing centers we need. And here's what kind of integrity and security, but also liberality we're going to have at the border, you know, and we craft this thing. Okay, then the question would be, you go into Washington, I'm not saying overnight because they're at each other's throats. Over the next 5 years, which party would be more prone to accepting that kind of as you look at them now, you know them better than I at this stage. You go to, hey, you go to the Republic, RNC, and say, here's run on this. You'll win on this. Americans will love that. Or you go to the DNC, and that, which one would be more receptive?
I don't think the Republic is going to be receptive anytime now, anytime soon, because I do think that sort of the cultural conservative, the sort of xenophobic wing is much more sort of not necessarily, it's not necessarily a majority, but they're like the loudest and angriest people right now. And they're getting a lot of, even though there's some odd little, you know, I talked about how ironic it is that somebody named Manarino would be anti-immigrant. Well, we got a guy named Vivek Ramaswamy who's anti-immigrant. And it's like not even two generations back. It's his father. It's his parents who came, right? People that they go very nativist. So that there's a very strong nativist contingent that I think the Republicans won't be able to contradict anytime soon. I'm not sure, though, that you're going to get, you know,
and
get
the DN, when you go to the DNC, are they going to accept it?
Or why, I think, well, I think you could get them to say that would be great in theory, but you know, the thing is they're going to say, but you know, get somebody else, get somebody to propose it. What I think the only thing
would get somebody else, why would
they say get
it?
Somebody to propose it, meaning not just you and I, because we don't have a constituency.
No, they'd say, what I'm saying is, why in the Democratic Party is there no constituency for saying we want to let in millions?
Maybe that's an interesting question. Well, and I think
of legal immigrants.
I bet there is a constituency there.
Because it, like, if you go to them now and say, we want everyone to vote, as you do, dear Democrats, but we want them to document themselves. We want them to bring an ID to the thing. And their view, no ID, no documentation. It sounds very similar to the border. Well, they don't want,
yeah, the ID thing, first of all, comes out of the history of voter suppression techniques.
Why do they not want documentation either of voters or of immigrants? It does seem.
I do think that in the mainstream DNC. Now, here's what I think is the way it's actually going to happen. Anything like this is ever actually going to happen. It's going to look like the YIMBY groups, the YIMBY movement. And this is one that I think is the most interesting things that happened politically, because it's something actually good that's happening for the most part. I mean, there are better and worse versions of it, but this is the yes in my backyard. The idea of saying, you know, if you're in San Francisco, you know, they have the problem with the NIMBYism. They're not in my backyard. You can't build this. You can't build that. And then pretty soon nobody can, you know, housing becomes extremely expensive. And you've had this movement there that it started in San Francisco and it spread many other places where they say, no, actually, we need to get rid of some of the zoning laws. We need to get rid of some of the restrictions and some of the things that are, you know, that prevent people from building new housing and new development. And, that has been something interesting that percolated up sort of from the grassroots and outside of the usual partisan lines. So, you know, the thing I always found funny about the YIMBYs is it's a bunch of like young urban Democrats who are basically arguing for deregulation. And it kind of gives me a kick that they don't exactly think of it in those terms. They think of, you know, they put it in terms that like, well, this is about helping us have more affordable housing, but it's like we get more affordable housing by getting rid of regulations. So, and it actually got, Obama said something to that effect at the DNC, and Harris said something to that effect. And, you know, I if you look at their actual proposals, it's like a mixture of a couple of good things. And, you know, she's going to subsidize people to buy houses, which is actually more likely to happen than actually getting rid of the regulations. But at least it's percolating up and getting attention. And I think that's, it's going to have to happen by somehow gaining a bipartisan constituency that isn't, that is working this issue outside of the normal partisan politics for a while, and then bringing that back up and bringing that from the grassroots up to the national level. Because right now what you have is the typical politics that we have, which is every side is beholden to its most radical wing. And right now, you know, we have a very close election again, and so, you know, each side says, oh, I don't dare tick off that, you know, there may be 8% of our voters who absolutely will not accept a certain policy or absolutely demand a certain policy. I don't dare tick those people off because I need all 8% of those, because I know I can't. It's so close. I can't win without them. And they will actually, you know, and some of them are, you know, the crazier people are, the more likely they are to say, oh, I'm just going to stay home. And even if they hate the other guy more, they're just going to, you know, they have this sort of suicide bomber kind of mentality towards voting. So
can I just say something about, because we don't have much time left. Yeah. I don't know, Lawrence, whether you have questions in the hopper. I just wanted to say something quickly, because you mentioned it earlier, Rob, when we were talking about Friedman. Yeah. Someone did try to split the baby on this, and they came up with a, I forget the number, composition in California, and it was in the 90s. And this is when people were worried about too much immigration and bankrupting the welfare system in California. So I remember this specifically because I was debating someone at the time. And the proposition was, you can come in, but you have to sign a waiver. You can't get on welfare, you know, for some period of time, and 5 years or something like that. And guess what? It was challenged all the way up to the courts. The courts rejected it as unequal treatment. It violated the 14th Amendment. In other words, you can't pick this citizen and say they can't get welfare and that. As long as they're eligible, they get to. And of course, the counter to that was, they're not citizens yet. The whole point is they're illegals. And so they don't. Well, but the minute they step on the soil, they get all the rights of citizens. So that has been tried, actually. And that kind of confirms Friedman's view that once you have this welfare system, you cannot carve out exceptions and keep them off the system. But adding to that, we know what happened subsequently. Not only was that rejected, the whole sanctuary city phenomenon developed after that, where it was, especially in California, you know, in Oregon and Portland and Seattle, they went the route of not just saying you can't be on the welfare rolls. They went the route of saying, please come here, especially if you're illegal and undocumented, because ICE is chasing you or INS is chasing you. And the whole point of sanctuary was kind of anarchy. It was kind of the idea that what the sanctuary we're keeping here is you being protected from federal law. And to the extent the federal government is responsible for the borders, that was a kind of lawless, outrageous, it's still going on, of course. There's at least 25 cities in America flouting the law, flagrantly flouting the law, and they're all Democratic cities. So yeah, you have to be troubled by that. That is a kind of lawlessness that the anti-immigration people just eat up. And I'm not anti-immigration, but those are the kind of things that make the wall, I call them the wall people, that gets the wall people so upset. It is kind of outrageous, isn't it? Sanctuary cities.
Maybe I don't find it nearly as outrageous as you do, because I think it has to do with the problem of enforcing something like that in a federal system like we have. Right. That when you and you could probably find some federal laws that are not well enforced. Here's a great example. There's a whole bunch of local officials who have said they won't enforore certain gun laws.
Yes, that's.
It's the exact same thing. Rufus T. Wainwright in the rural county out there, somewhere, tells his constituency that if they pass this law against take away your firearms, I'm not going to enforce it.
Okay, you know who's at fault for this? This is nullification. We know nullification, right, Rob? Goes all the way back to the Jeffersonian theory that if I don't think that's constitutional, I don't have to obey. Like Biden kind of did that on the Constitution with student loans.
Well, yeah, he tried.
So a local San Francisco mayor will say, I don't like the immigration laws of the federal government, so I'm not going to enforce them in San Francisco. Right.
But I think it has to do with
that kind of violation.
It's a caution, but it's also, I view it as almost a feature of the system in one respect, which is anytime the federal government says, oh, we're going to come doing some big restrictive thing, the federal government doesn't have that many law enforcement agents. You know, it doesn't have that many troops. It doesn't have, you know, national, you know, it doesn't have federal troops on the streets of every city. In fact, it's banned from having troops on the streets of our cities, except, you know, the National Guard, which are under control of the states. So there's this whole system. So the federal government can make big restrictive. I mean, this is like, go back to prohibition in the 1920s. Well,
this is not so much restricted. This is just the government saying we should have documented immigrants. And
it's documentation within the context of a highly restricted system.
But if a Democrat city says, literally, they put up a sign, we are a magnet, welfare magnet and for illegals, that is lawless.
So here's the thing. If you have the question of should we have more immigrants or not, and people in the local area says, we think more immigrants would be great, then you're going to have trouble enforcing that law that highly restricts immigrants.
To me, it's very similar to the voting thing. It's perplexing.
I've got a great analogy for you. Very, this is exactly like the debate.
When someone says, why don't you just document the voter?
Why don't we just document people owning guns? There's a whole long gun registration argument, right? Yeah. And it sounds reasonable. Why not document the people who have guns?
I think we should.
The reason why the gun rights groups have fought this all the time for as long as I can remember is, then you have a list of people whose guns you can confiscate. So again, there's an old thing called Barone's Law, Michael Barone, yeah, you know, old political column, yeah. And he said all process arguments are insincere, including this one, which I was like,
there's always the a part. Substantive argument behind
it. That anything about saying, well, we're not against this, I just think we should register it, that the process is never the heart of the issue. The process is what the actual substance of it is, what's happening. So I think the substance of the issue is more immigrants versus less immigrants. And so, then if that's the position that people actually have, more immigrants versus less immigrants, that distorts and colors how they view the process argument.
So if I were to summarize this, I would say you and I want order at the border, but we want lots of immigrants to come in. We want lots of immigrants to come in legally. We'd rather illegal things not be done, and both at the border and inside the border. I think we both agree both parties are so far apart on anything like that. Mm-hmm. I think we're scratching our heads a little bit on why. I think you blame the Republicans and the conservatives and the right more than I would, but I'd say a pox on both their houses.
There are nutty people on the left too. I will never contradict that.
Lawrence, any people that want to criticize us heavily and dismiss our arguments or?
Well, I think both of your had really good positions here, and that
we're not really
a lot of the questions.
Yeah,
you had a lot of questions that were already answered just by you two talking. A lot of them were about, for example, Kingfisher 21 on YouTube asked about the whole pause on immigration after World War I. There was that pause.
Yeah,
that something that was more important to help people sort of naturalize to a general sort of culture that's already here? You all kind of talked about
one thing I wanted to mention about assimilation, though, is that one thing we had in the early 20th century is there were voluntary organizations. This wasn't a government effort.
Oh,
it was
I know.
All sorts of private organizations saying, okay, here, we're going to help you assimilate. We're going to teach you English. Yeah. We're going to teach you how to make American food, which was maybe, if the Italians are coming in, maybe that's not a good idea. Let them make Italian food. But the point is that there were volunteer organizations. So one thing I say about people who are really super concerned about assimilation, well, go start some of those organizations and you probably find a lot of immigrants, legal and illegal, who'd be perfectly happy to get free lessons on English or to these other attempts to help people settle or lessons on the American constitutional system of government.
Rob, that was true of the pre-welfare society. Also, these mutual aid societies and things like that. Yeah, you can either argue that they decayed and then the government stepped in, or you could say the government stepped in and displaced them all. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Now, even cute little things like Little Italy or Chinatown, even when immigrants came in and didn't assimilate to the extent that they congregated and concentrated in certain areas, even those were adorable. I mean, they're adorable. The Americans would go in there and let's spend the night in Chinatown and everything. And they were welcoming. But when you think about it, they were unassimilated, but they were also not bothering anybody. You know, ethnic tension over it. It was kind of cute.
And one of the things I've noticed is that, one of the things immigrants always bring to this country is new food. You can go get something called pho, which is a Vietnamese soup. It's a delicious Vietnamese soup. You can get that. There's a Thai, you get really excellent Thai food.
Oh, the Thai food,
In this country and everywhere. And you can get sushi just about anywhere.
That's the missing link. That is the only thing all sides agree on. The food's great. The food variety is great. So maybe the only thing that brings these two parties together and gets a rational immigration policy is a food element. I don't know. There's gonna be
let in the chefs. Let in the cooks and the chefs and the nonas who will make their favorite family recipes and pass them on to us.
Have cook-offs and saying whoever wins the cook-off, will you widen your quotas or something? I don't know. Yeah, it's crazy.
And and their whole swaths of America where tacos are as American as apple pie. or Pete, I came across something hilarious. It was in the Atlantic in 1949. There was an article very seriously explaining this exotic new food to that Americans aren't familiar with called pizza.
Yeah.
Which is now you consider it like it's an American, a totally American dish. Yeah. And there's, every region has its own style of pizza, but it was totally new. And, 1949, it was new and exotic.
I know.
Well, I think that's a microcosm for the fact that, again, I started with this idea of looking at new people, not as a burden, but as
as a blessing, as producers, as people who can bring something positive.
Agree
and the
with
food
that.
Is the one area where people can actually see that, that yes, these immigrants coming in, they're bringing dishes that I enjoy going out and eating. So yeah, I think that's kind of a microcosm that there are all sorts of other examples of how immigrants coming in will bring positive things. It's just, that's the one that's most visible and hardest to argue with.
Any other questions, Lawrence, or comments that seem interesting to you or that you want to pose us yourself?
Well, there is a question here, and you both have already touched on this before, but this is by Alan Turner on YouTube, who asks, question, why do both libertarians and Democrats love open borders? Now, of course, that's a whole thing of itself that could take a long time. But when you mention Democrat, it reminds me of course, it's not up, down, uniform, and the way, because of course Democratic Party by and large for a long time in the past was against immigration, but there is sort of like the rise in recent years of the sort of international socialist types, sort of harkening back to days past of like, well, you would say like, what, Lenin, we should be free to go around and work wherever you go. So there's that group, and then there's the Democrats at large. So I think the libertarians, it's easy to say that by and large that's open borders is sort of their policy. Maybe y'all want to talk a little more about this sort of change in the Democrat view.
On the libertarians, I want to say that libertarians have a long, long history of having big, knockdown, furious debates over issues that are not all relevant to anything that's happening in American politics today. Right. So that's what I call it Libertarian Debate Club. Like, they had a whole thing. They gave Gary Johnson a hard time at a libertarian debate because he wasn't against driver's licenses. And this was considered the litmus test. You had to be against issuing driver's license because that's the state telling you what to do. And so the Libertarian Party tends to have like, what's the most futile position I can take? And then that's what they go for. Or I saw some guy, Free Ross Ulbricht t-shirt on the other day. You know, these very niche issues that only a few people who are very online know who Ross Ulbricht is. So that kind of explains the libertarians. But on the Democrat side, I think both parties, reasonable people in both parties are not well served by the leadership and national agenda of the parties. And that's, again, because you have these radical wings that, and this tends to happen in politics, but it's happening, I think, more now, a little more now than it used to, that you have radical wings who have to be appeased. And you know, the biggest problem I had, it's the idea of 50 plus one. That there became the more that, you know, when's the last time we had an actual landslide presidential election? It was 1984, Reagan. Everyone after that has been much closer. I mean, there've been, you know, maybe Obama's second time did a little better, but they've been very, very close elections. And parties have had much more of a message that's basically aimed at, let's get 50% of the population plus one. And, you know, Trump won with 45, you know, so they people figure out sometimes, you know, if things are divided and there are spoilers in the race and the electoral college tips your way, you can actually, you don't even need to get 50%. And when you have that attitude, you end up saying, okay, what do we do to appease the loudest and most fanatical people? Or in the Democratic Party version, it's the loudest and most extremely online people, right? How do you appease the people who are on social media all day and will gang up on you and yell at you if you don't, you know, state whatever the latest, you know, defund the police or whatever the latest, which is like the most unpopular message the Democrats, I think, have ever had, was defund the police. But they had to say it because you had these, you know, fanatics who would give you a hard time for it. So I think that's part of the problem, is that you need to have a system. You need to find some way. And like YIMBYism is one rare example where you get like reasonable people from both parties who say, you know what, that's not a bad idea. And you can maybe hopefully change change the consensus from below and create something that's big enough that the fanatics can't block it.
Yeah, I don't really want to comment on the libertarians because I don't think they're influential. But I did want to say something that might clarify things for people on the Republican side, which I do tend to analyze more closely. I'm intrigued by. It's very disturbing, this devolution from Reagan to Bush to Trump. And just quickly, Reagan, think about it, very good on immigration, favorable to importing people, if you will. But he also was for free trade with Canada, free trade with Mexico, and gave us the beginnings of NAFTA. He was also anti-establishment. Well, Trump is too, to some extent. Remember, Reagan was kind of an outsider, the Nixon, Rockefeller wing, the Bush wing. So Reagan wins two landslides with that message. And it's a very, you know, pro-founding fathers message, but it's also future-looking, benevolent, no name-calling, optimism, mourning in America, right? Yeah. Trump could not be more different, except that he stole the line, make America great again, which actually came from Reagan. The Reagan-Bush team in 1980, their tagline was, let's make America great again. And they got no shit for it because it was like a normal aspiration people had. Now, look at Trump. It's a broader context. He's not just, and you could say this about Vance too. What do they share that's anti-Reagan? They're anti-immigration. So they're anti-importing people, but they're also anti-importing goods. They're protectionists. They're anti, goods coming into Walmart. They're also for industrial policy, which used to be a Dukakis thing. Remember, Rob, the Democrats and they used to call them the Atari Democrats. They used to be for industrial planning and stuff. Reagan wasn't. Reagan resisted that. Reagan was against that. So the Trump Vance lineup on almost every issue, even though they call themselves Republicans, they're really anti-free trade, anti-immigration, industrial policy, and the pessimism and the backward looking part of it and the fatalism is so un-Reagan. It's so unlike Reagan. It's remarkable to see a political party, and I think the Democrats have deteriorated badly as well. They both deteriorated very badly, but it is disturbing to see when the Republicans basically have this history, and they had it with Lincoln as well, frankly. They have this model that succeeded and had landslides, and no one will go back. I don't want them to go back for the sake of going back. I'm just saying it's not as if a successful model actually doesn't exist. It was a model that was closest to capitalism that we're probably ever going to get in our lifetime. And even the objectivist hated Reagan, remember, Rob? So I'm bothered by that. Yeah. But it is starkly different, isn't it? But there is a commonality in this. The anti-foreign anything is all part of the Trump message now. And I think the only question is whether this is idiosyncratic to him, namely when he's off the stage, the Republican Party will go back to sanity, or whether he's in the Republican Party because it's gone insane.
Yeah, well, so I just had a piece go up at Discourse Magazine yesterday addressing this idea of what's the difference between Trump and Reagan. And the fundamental that I saw was, again, pessimism versus optimism. Yeah. And Reagan was populist in the sense of appealing to the common man against the elites and the bureaucrats. But he appealed to him in a positive way of like, you know, but basically here are our highest principles. And here's how we can have a better future. And Trump tends to appeal to fear and declinism. Yeah. He says we're like a third world country. Yeah. And I, you know, something I didn't put in that piece, but I was thinking about was, you know, Reagan comes along in 1980 and we're in the middle of economic decline, stagnation, foreign policy catastrophes. And, Carter calls it a national malaise. And Reagan says very famously, I think our best days are ahead.
Yeah.
And Trump comes along in a period right now, which for all the problems we have lower unemployment than we had under Reagan, even under the Reagan recovery, I believe. Very low unemployment. We have we're wealthier than we were then. We're not actively involved in any wars directly involved in any wars right now. We got, you know, it's peace and prosperity by the standard of most of American history. And Reagan and Trump says, oh, we're like a third world country. And I think there's a self-fulfilling prophecy to that. If you have this doom and gloom attitude, you will tend to do things that make it worse. Whereas if you have the attitude of, look, we have all these capabilities, we just need to let ourselves, you know, be free to do these things, then you're going to more likely to adopt policies that will actually, and I think Reagan actually did, make America great again, you know, but from 1980 to 1988. I mean, especially if you extend that to 1990 and fall of the Berlin Wall, then, he all those things, the economy, foreign policy, the fate of freedom in the world, all those things dramatically reversed and he made America great again. But it's because he had that positive vision of how to do it.
Yeah, and one sign politically, you know this, Rob, one sign politically that there's a kind of semi-revolution going on that's successful is when the other party copies you. So to me, the entire 90s, Gore, even Gore of all people, pushing for NAFTA, you know, against Ross Perot.
Yeah.
So Clinton, you know, welfare reform.
In 1999.
And keep those tax rates down. And he realized he had to ape the Reagan programs pretty much, not change them too much, to be successful in the 90s. So the Reagan years and the influence of the Reagan years kind of like spilled over into the
90s. Well, a successful example. An successful example inspires imitators. In 1999, I remember going to a gathering of right of center political types from across the world. So you had a bunch of American Republicans and British Conservative Party people, and then a smattering of people from other European countries. And the universal complaint there, oh, it's really terrible. Why is it terrible? Well, they're stealing our agenda. I'm like, looking at them saying, you know, this is what's called winning.
Yeah.
When you win on the issues, the other guy steals your agenda.
But the Brits did the same thing. I remember Tony Blair was
It was the British people saying labor. That too. Yeah.
They called it New Labour. And I think it was I recall like under Tony Blair in the 90s or I forget when it was the first time they ever dropped the nationalization plank from the Labour Party, you know, and it had been there since 1918. And it took till Tony Blair for them to say, and maybe we shouldn't nationalize industries. And now that Thatcher has privatized most of them, but things can really change because those 20 years, call it 1980 to 2000, remarkably in the direction, I would say, of capitalism, not fully there, but what a remarkable turnaround. Because I think of the last 20 years as definitely going the other way. And who would have guessed that at the turn of the century, who would have guessed looking back 20 years, and all the progress and the winning the Cold War and all that, and Reagan and Thatcher, and who would have guessed that standing here now, the whole world went the other way. I think the whole world went the other way. It's not as catastrophic, Rob, I agree, it's the way Trump paints it, but it really did reverse.
There is a definite reversal there. Some people call it a freedom recession, but I think a good issue to end on would be the fact that I think this issue of turning towards markets and optimism to notice that those two things are connected, and maybe there's a reason they're connected.
Yeah,
you know, there's a certain view of the world and of human capability that, you know, we can go out and build and create things that goes hand in hand with the pro-market, pro-capitalist approach. Yeah. And when we turn against that, you know, we end up that goes hand in hand with the pessimistic. Oh, you know, we're losing everything. We're declining. We have to claw down other people and try to keep other people out in order to keep us from declining.
And the same thing you see historically when reason is doubted and you're in a medieval, you know, dark ages, the pessimism is enormous, right? Mm-hmm. And then enlightenment and renaissance, the optimism, it definitely goes, if we use our faculty of awareness, if our main tool, reason, all of a sudden we're confident. How surprising. When reason is under attack, all of a sudden we feel like we're animals. Yeah, because you surrendered the one thing that distinguishes you from animals. So we start acting like animals. Mm-hmm. I like that connection between, it's basically reason, liberty, optimism. They go together. If you're rejecting reason, if you're going woke, if you're going postmodernism, you're going to be illiberal and you're going to be pessimistic. I think. What do you think, Lawrence?
I think that is...
Should we stop?
It's a great... We've gone over time, but I think there's a lot of stuff here that's really covered. I'm still processing it. I know everyone else in chat probably is too, but I think y'all did a great job of answering pretty much the questions as they came in, whether you knew the questions were there or not. So I want to thank both of you for jumping on to do this today.
Thank you.
And I want to thank everyone in the audience, Rob, for asking these questions. And besides, if you enjoyed this video, of course, as always, make sure to check out the rest of our content and support our work at theatlassociety.org/donate. And be sure to join us next week when Jennifer Grossman will be back, and she'll be interviewing Professor of Economics at George Mason University, Brian Kaplan, about his new book, Build Baby Build, The Science and Ethics of Housing Regulation. Richard, Rob, thanks again for today.
Thanks, Lawrence. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, everyone.
Enjoyed it. Thanks.